58.
I'm sorry,
says Sergeant Bertzos through the speakerphone.
We're short-staffed on a good day and it's past midnight now. I couldn't possibly summon the manpower anytime soon.
Books and I look at each other. This is what we figured.
Maybe the state police?
Bertzos suggests.
They're usually the ones to do roadblocks.
Books shakes his head.
We couldn't do it fast enough and we wouldn't know the boundaries. We don't know where he's going next. That's okay,
he says.
Listen, Sergeant, can you put us through to the officers at the scene? I can do that. Give me your number.
3 minutes later, the direct line on my office phone rings. I push speaker and answer.
This is Officer Janet Dowling, says the voice through the speakerphone.
This is Special Agent Harrison Bookman, officer. And I have with me Emmy Dockery, an analyst with the Bureau. Can you hear me okay?
I'm inside my patrol car right now, so yeah.
Officer, is there a crowd there at the scene?
Not as much as there was when the fire was roaring, but yeah, there's a crowd. Maybe 2 dozen people?
Give me your cell number if you would. I want to send you something.
10 years ago, the idea that you could transmit an image by phone was unimaginable. Now it's annoying if it takes more than 10 seconds.
Okay, got it. It didn't come through real clear, though.
That's because it isn't clear. This is security camera footage, best we can do. The subject is a male Caucasian, a bit under 6 feet tall, maybe bald in this picture at least, average build, probably early to mid-30s.
Got it.
Take a look through the crowd, officer. And can someone take a picture of the crowd?
Yes, we can. So you think he's here, watching his artwork?
It's possible.
Books glances at me. Neither of us really think the subject is there, but you never know.
Agent, our fire captain says it doesn't look like arson. I mean, there hasn't been an investigation yet, but he's been doing this a long time and his instincts are good.
Books catches the look on my face. Several dozen fire captains and arson investigators have been wrong so far.
We believe it's arson, I say, and that he's very good at hiding it.
Very good.
Books says,
question everyone there, officer. Treat it like a crime scene.
Will do.
But try to keep this below the radar,
says Books.
Our subject doesn't think we're chasing him right now. No reason to let him know. Not yet.
We end the phone call. Books checks his phone. A text message.
Okay, the rapid response team is on their way to the plane. I better get going.
I start to say something, but stop. My eyes move to my duffel bag in the corner of the room. I've packed 3 days' worth of clothes and toiletries should the need arise.
Better you stay here,
Books says.
You have lots to do.
If I really wanted to put my foot down and come along, Books would acquiesce. But he's right. We've already discussed this. We've just received an information dump from the Lyle and Champaign police departments full of information on Joelle Swanson and Curtis Valentine. That's what we analysts do, right? We sift through data while the agents run out for the excitement. An awkward moment hangs between us. Nothing makes sense. Not a hug, not a handshake.
Be careful, I say to him, and keep in touch.
59. Books's image appears on the laptop, his words coming a beat after his lips move.
You got me okay?
We got you, I say, with Sophie and Denny seated next to me.
Nothing major to report, sorry to say,
says Books.
New Britain is a sleepy little town. The victim, Nancy McKinley, is an accountant who works in Hartford. She left for the day at 5:15, stopped at a grocery store just outside New Britain, then went home. That's the last anyone heard from her.
We didn't see anything on the video from the grocery store, says Denny.
Nothing that jumped out at us, but we're going to keep looking.
He wouldn't have been dumb enough to put down a credit card at the store, I say. He probably didn't enter the store at all. He just waited for her to leave.
Her son, Joseph, said she wasn't dating anybody and didn't have any plans for this weekend,
says Books.
So maybe our subject just rang her doorbell and forced his way in.
I turn to Sophie. This is her assignment, checking emails and any social media that the victim would have used that might tip us off.
I'm still looking at it, she says, but so far nothing.
We have the state police on standby in Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York,
Books says.
Okay, so tell me what you've learned.
I take a quick look over my notes, a summary of the work of several people on our team. On the day he died, Curtis Valentine had an appointment on his calendar at 4 p.m. to meet a man named Joe Swanson from Lisle, Illinois, I say.
You're shitting me.
I'm not. Our subject used a male version of Joel Swanson's name to set up an appointment with the next person he was going to kill, Curtis Valentine. We've traced a cell phone call, a burner cell, of course, untraceable, from Lisle, Illinois, to Curtis Valentine's office phone on August 22nd. That's the same day he killed Joel Swanson.
So he killed Joel in Lisle, and while there, he set up his next murder a week later.
Yes. I glance at my notes. Apparently this Joe Swanson said that he was starting up a new business but wouldn't say what, and he'd been burned by his last website designer, so he wanted to meet Curtis face to face.
Smart,
says Books.
Very smart. Curtis probably invited him to his home to show off his equipment. And what about Joel Swanson?
Nothing, I say. She had nothing on her computer, or from anything we're hearing anecdotally, to indicate she was planning on meeting anybody. Books doesn't respond to that. It's not hard to see how this is playing out. Our subject feels comfortable confronting women at their homes, but not so much the men. From what we can tell, he somehow forced his way into the homes of Joel Swanson and Nancy McKinley, but set up an appointment with Curtis Valentine so he'd be invited in. Is that how it happened with Marta? Did she just answer the door, thinking that our subject was a door-to-door salesman, a guy looking for directions, a meter reader with the electric company? She would have done that. Marta would have opened the door to anybody. She never saw the dark side of anything, only the light.
Okay,
says Books. On the screen, he looks down at his watch. It's just after 4 o'clock Central Standard Time, an hour later where Books is in Connecticut. Today is Saturday, meaning today will be the second murder, the second fire. Ugh, if we could issue a warning. But what can we tell people? A murky photograph, no name attached to it, no area of vulnerability, not even an MO to point to with any specificity. Hey, everyone who lives in the northeastern United States, be on the lookout for a white guy of average height. He might force his way into your house and torture you and burn your house down.
We've sent a bulletin to all local jurisdictions in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New York to alert us immediately to any residential fires of any magnitude,
Books says.
With any luck, we'll have word of the fire tonight less than an hour after it happens.
We'll be ready here, I say, trying to avoid raising my hopes, but knowing that we are in the game now, that tonight, possibly, could be the break we've been waiting for. 60.
Graham Session, recording number 14, September 15th, 2012. I'll say this for the northeastern part of the country. You sure do change seasons well. There is nothing more majestic than the turning of the leaves up here. Granted, it's a bit on the early side, so I'll have to come back this way in October to see the full blooming of fall. But you can see the beginnings of it, like a beautiful woman's coming of age, so full of mystery and promise, so vibrant and invigorating. Puts a real spring in a man's step, does it not? Well, I get like this sometimes after I'm done with a session, kind of sentimental and, I might admit, giddy, even euphoric. There is so much to love about what I do, especially the ways I do it nowadays. Do you see what I see in its beauty, in its raw honesty? There's an old saying that people are at their most honest at birth and at death. Do you know who said that? It was me. You probably thought I was going to say Robert Frost or Philip Roth, but seriously, it was just me. You ever read those famous sayings on the internet or in some book of famous quotations and think, goodness, I wish I had just one of those attributed to me? After all, Will Rogers has at least 10 of them. Winston Churchill has dozens, as do many of our famous presidents. I want just one. That's all. Just a single, memorable utterance of truth, so perceptive that it sticks with you forever. A remark generally hurts in proportion to its truth. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. A lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on. People are at their most honest when they are born and when they die. Yes, yes, indeed. I dare say my quote holds up quite nicely in that company. But this isn't about me, dear audience. It's about you. What do you think of my brilliance? Enough, then. I've had my time this evening with this fine gentleman, Dr. Padman Abhan, and my sincerest apologies if I've butchered the pronunciation of his name, though I suppose if you asked him, he'd say it wasn't the worst thing that happened to him tonight. And now it's time for me to take my leave. But before I do, I would only ask you, do I sound like someone who is troubled? Of course not. I'm at the top of my game, and I'm still having fun. What could that merry woman possibly have been thinking? I'll be back to speak with you tomorrow. Traffic has probably cleared sufficiently on I-95 now, so I best be on my way. End.
61.
The neighbors say that Dr. Padmanabhan lived alone,
says the officer. Thank you, officer. Please hold. I click off the phone and punch the button on my radio for Books. Books, do you copy?
Copy, Emmy.
Scenario 2, I say. Scenario 2. Call came in from Providence, Rhode Island.
Scenario 2, copy that. Make the call.
30 seconds later, Books and I are on a conference call with the superintendent of the Rhode Island State Police and the commander of the Connecticut State Police, both of whom have been standing by for my call. This is Scenario 2, Rhode Island and Connecticut.
Rhode Island copies that,
says Superintendent Adam Vernon.
Our troopers are in place.
Connecticut copies, says Commander Ingrid Schwegel. Our troops are in place as well.
We feel good about I-95? I ask, just to ease my nerves. It's already been the topic of discussion.
Agent,
says Superintendent Vernon, mistaking my title.
If the suspect is headed back to the Midwest, his only route is through Connecticut, and the only highway that makes any kind of sense is I-95. There are 41 miles of border, but if he isn't expecting anyone to be waiting for him, he'd be a fool not to take I-95.
Very good, I say. The fire call came in 14 minutes ago, and I just got confirmation that it's the fire we're targeting. My map says the fire is located just north of Miriam Hospital in Providence, which means he has to travel 40 miles down I-95 to reach the Connecticut-Rhode Island border.
Even if he got a head start, says Vernon, there's no way he's reached the border yet. But I've already given the order, Agent. As we speak, the flares are going up. This is Agent Bookman. I'm airborne and should be at the border in 15 minutes. I'll be the agent in charge, but we'll have agents on the ground joining you shortly. Let's be clear on the directive. Plate numbers and VINs of any vehicle with a male loosely fitting the description. Permissive searches at a minimum. Anything suspicious, anything at all, your troopers will have my direct contact.
Connecticut copies.
Rhode Island copies, says Vernon. If he's on the road tonight, we'll get him.
62. The feed from the FBI helicopter comes through with surprising clarity on my laptop. An overhead view of Interstate 95 as it moves south-southwest from Rhode Island into North Stonington, Connecticut. A split-level highway with two lanes heading southwest, plus a shoulder. At the border, beneath signs that read Connecticut Welcomes You and North Stonington Town Line, state trooper vehicles from both states have set up a vehicular blockade perpendicular to the lanes of traffic. Flares precede the blockade for as far as the screen permits me to see, probably a half mile at least, or whatever the protocol is for roadblocks. The road is jammed with vehicles waiting in line. At the checkpoint, officers and FBI agents shine flashlights into cars, both the front and back seats, sometimes pop the trunk and check it, sometimes direct the car to pull over to the shoulder for a more thorough search, and always record the license plate and VIN number located inside the front door. Once allowed to leave, the vehicles must do an awkward bend around squad cars, then over to the shoulder, before they proceed into Connecticut. Not exactly the welcome they were expecting from the Constitution State. The highway is backed up as far as I can see, even as late as it is, near midnight Eastern Standard Time. No doubt drivers assume that this is a Saturday night sobriety check, and it turns out to be just that for a couple of unlucky drivers, who end up having their cars impounded and taking a ride to the lockup in North Stonington. The helicopter moves along the highway, looking for any vehicles attempting to turn around, and I see for the first time that there is a second helicopter doing the same thing. Books is feeding me names and license plates and VINs as we go along, and I'm running them for criminal backgrounds and for stolen vehicles. I don't think our subject would drive a stolen car. A criminal background? Hard to say. It obviously wouldn't surprise me if he had one, but for some reason, I suspect he has a clean record. He's just that meticulous. I've been managing my expectations here, but there's no hiding the truth. We have a real chance tonight. Each car that leads our team to take a second look, to pop the trunk, even to move them over to the shoulder, raises the hair on the back of my neck. And that gives the hair on the back of my neck a lot of exercise, because most of the cars receive extended attention from our team of state troopers and FBI agents. Most of the drivers are men, and the majority of them Caucasian. And we don't narrow it down all that much when you throw in average height, average build, and who knows what for his hair. But in the end, each of these cars is allowed to pass. I'm not wrong about this. He drives to a new part of the country, commits two murders, and returns home. The data doesn't lie. And he must live in the Midwest. He must. The patterns of his travel can be tied to major highways. I'm not wrong. He's a driver, and he's driving back to the Midwest. He could have taken a different route. Like the police superintendent said, there are 41 miles of border. But he isn't expecting us, and why wouldn't he take Interstate 95? Of course he would. The first 90 minutes are slow and ultimately uneventful. And then it speeds up because the number of cars diminishes. The backlog disappears as the hour approaches 2 in the morning. There just aren't that many cars crossing into Connecticut at this time. After a Dodge minivan passes through the blockade, there is a stretch when no cars are on the highway heading southwest. Interstate 95 is empty.
Where the hell is he?
Books spits, exasperated.
This made all kinds of sense.
I know, I concede. I thought we had him. There's no chance he turned around when he saw the blockade?
No chance. There's a trooper up ahead at the first flare, idling on the shoulder. If any vehicle tried to turn around and cross the median, he would have seen it. We've had that covered. Damn!
Maybe he's getting some rest first, I say. Getting an early start tomorrow. Books doesn't answer immediately. Frustrated or concentrating. Probably the latter. Books doesn't let his emotions overtake him much. He was always the rational to my emotional. I suppose it's possible he was in one of those cars, I say. Remember who we're dealing with.
Maybe, maybe. Not many Midwestern license plates, though.
True. But that won't stop me from starting a database and throwing all these names and plate numbers in it.
We're going to keep this checkpoint up until dawn at least,
he says.
We can't do this forever, but let's give it until sunlight and revisit it then. Sound good?
I'm not going anywhere, I say, keeping up a brave front. But somewhere inside me, I can't help feeling that we've missed him. We set up a spider web, but he somehow sidestepped it. Somewhere along the way, I fell too in love with my own analysis, sure that he would behave according to the model I created from the data. And because I missed, next week, he'll do this all over again in another part of the country to two more helpless victims. 63. I sit, poised over my computer, running the checks, my brain power dissipating, my eyes heavy, my back and neck in full-scale revolt. I refuse to look at the clock on the wall, knowing that the little hand is about to hit the 8 and the big hand the 12.
knowing that the roadblock's now been up for more than 10 hours.
"One more hour," I say to Books through my headset.
"That's what you said an hour ago,"
he replies into my ear.
"One more hour."
We had originally planned on ending the roadblock at 8 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, or 7 Chicago time. I pushed it an hour to 9 o'clock EST, which is coming up now.
"There isn't even that much traffic," I argue.
A small line of cars have backed up in Rhode Island on their way into Connecticut, but nothing approaching major gridlock.
"It's Sunday morning. It's not like we're causing commuters a big pain."
"We can't keep this up forever, Emmy."
"Sure we can. We're the FBI.
A pause. Maybe I'm winning another hour. He has to come through this roadblock sooner or later, I tell myself. He has to. Even though another part of me is admitting that somehow I've miscalculated.
"No, I'm calling it,"
says Books, as if he's recording a time of death.
"No, please, just one more—"
"Negative. I'll call you soon."
"Books!"
I yell, but there's no feedback. Books has disconnected the line. He knows what it's like arguing with me. He's correctly decided that it's better to just cut me off.
Shit!
I rip off my headset and throw it down on my desk. I get to my feet and a hot, slicing pain shoots up my back. My vision is blurred from staring at a computer screen all night. My brain, let's face it, is fried. I make it into the hallway and head down toward the war room, a converted conference room minus the long table, where 8 research analysts are working on our case. They came in this morning at 7 and have been doing full workups on the people we stopped at the roadblock, a total of more than 500 white adult men. I am woozy. My reaction's fuzzy. I hear animated discussion, then laughter. Laughter? And I quicken my pace toward the war room. Inside, one of the 2 male RAs is standing, doing something comical, an imitation of a goofy dance move or something. When he sees me, when the room becomes aware of me, everyone stops smiling and silence lingers awkwardly in the air. I look at each of them. These 7 new RAs plus Sophie Talamus. As I enter the room, I feel like some humorless parent interrupting a slumber party, a teacher walking in on a rambunctious classroom, and I hate it. But it doesn't stop me from going off. "The man we're after," I say slowly, my voice trembling, "scalps victims while they're still alive. You get that, right? He burns the flesh off their bodies while they're still alive. Stop me when I've said something funny." All eyes have dropped to the floor. Sophie says,
"Just blowing off some steam, Emmy. Everyone's working hard."
"Everyone's not working hard enough," I reply. "He's in here," I say, pointing to one of the laptop computers. "Somewhere in all this data, in some cross-reference we haven't done yet, in some database, on some blog or social media or website is our subject. It's up to us to find him, people. You all, in this room. He's not going to leave a fingerprint for one of our superstar special agents to find. He's not going to drop his wallet at the crime scene or trip and break his leg on the way out of a house he torches. He's not going to be spotted by some nosy neighbor. It's not going to be the field agents who find him. It's going to be us, the people in this room, the RAs. So screw your heads on and give me your A-game, people, because this asshole just slipped away from us for another week." I storm out of the room and head for the elevator, needing a shower and something to eat before I continue. It isn't until I'm out in the fresh air that I realize my car keys are back up in my office. 64. When I return to my office, Sophie Talamus is in there holding my keys.
"I think you forgot these," she says.
I snatch them from her.
"You had no right to say that to us, Emmy. These people are killing themselves for you. They're the most underpaid people in the entire bureau, yet they're working 15-hour days. They're here at 7 in the morning on a Sunday."
"Hey, you know what, Sophie?"
I throw up my hands.
"You want a 9-to-5 job? Go work at 7-Eleven or something. We're trying to catch a monster. It sometimes requires a little extra effort."
"I think we're clear on that."
"Are you? That's great."
I head for the door.
"We're not finished,"
Sophie says. I stop and turn.
"What did you say?"
Sophie, with her silky hair pulled up fashionably casual,
her skinny jeans and pretty knit blouse, her perfectly etched features, is fuming. When someone this attractive gets mad, her face doesn't turn ugly exactly. It's more like her features become highlighted, her eyes a little shinier, and her cheeks glowing more prominently.
We have a problem, don't we, Emmy? You and I.
I take a breath and hold out my hand.
Just do your job, Sophie, and
I'm doing my job. I'm working as hard as anyone, but what's our problem? You've given me nothing but dirty looks since the day I arrived.
I need you focused, I say. I need you to focus on this case and nothing else.
I'm not sleeping with him, Emmy.
I draw back, knocked on my heels by the comment. Sophie folds her arms and doesn't speak, letting those words linger between us.
There is so much to say and think about what she's just said. None of it good.
The fact that she acknowledges the issue at all means I've done something, body language, facial expression, something, to make it an issue, at least in her eyes. The fact that she is comfortable enough with books that she feels entitled to make such an announcement. The fact that she thinks I need to hear this from her, that we're even talking about this when there's a vicious sociopath at large.
I'm not, she says again. Books has been very good to me, very supportive. We're friends for sure. But that's all it is.
And then, I can't deny the small pang of relief that I feel, that I instantly sequester, because that's what I'm best at, right? Steeling myself, shutting down. My feelings for books, to the extent they exist, some residual feeling, some primitive sexual attraction, nothing more, don't matter, because I can put them aside to focus on this investigation. My sense of loss for Marta doesn't matter, because I can put that aside too. I click on any such feelings and drag them into my mental trash bin where they belong. I'm a girl standing in a tornado pretending like it isn't even windy, like I can compartmentalize every emotion, switch off my heart and divert every ounce of my energy into my brain, that I can be the girl who's all about the data, all about the clues, all about the puzzle, and forget about anything that makes me human. I'll have time to be human later. Later is one of my favorite words.
Do your job, I whisper to Sophie. That's all I care about.
65. I spend most of the afternoon in the war room, watching over the other RAs, checking their work, flagging anything that looks promising, though little of it does. There is some residual tension from my blow-up earlier in the day, but it gradually subsides as we focus on the work at hand. At 6 o'clock, somebody mentions dinner and we put in for some pizzas. I wander down to Books' office where our fearless leader has been taking calls from the various agents in the field since he returned from the Northeast a couple of hours ago.
Shit,
he says as I walk in, shaking his head. There is background noise, video from some source, maybe his smartphone. Books looks like hell, having spent all night in a helicopter over the Rhode Island, Connecticut border. His eyes are red and unfocused, his hair matted. His face is drawn and unshaven. What's up? I ask.
Oh, nothing.
He waves a hand.
My chief's got spanked for the second week in a row. CJ Spiller, the Bill's backup receiver, for Christ's sake, ran through our line like we're a bunch of high schoolers.
He lets out a sigh.
And Romeo's a defensive coach.
I drop into a chair opposite him. Books, you do understand that I have no idea who CJ Spillman or Romeo are.
Spiller,
he corrects me.
CJ Spiller is the backup.
And you also realize that I don't care. Books shakes his smartphone.
We're 0-2 now, and it feels like we're light years from the division title we won.
Books, what is it with men in football? I mean, it's like an addiction with you.
Me and millions of others.
I know, I agree. My dad was like that too. He'd sit in front of the television all day on Sunday and watch games. We had to work church around it, because we all knew what his real religion was. And then something happens. The clouds separate. My heart begins to race.
Football is the ultimate.
Books is waxing philosophical, but I'm no longer listening. I pop to my feet, which in my current state is not a good idea, and nearly fall over as I rush out of Books' office and into my own. I jump on my computer and bang out a solid hour of research,
my body overheated, my pulse reeling, my hands trembling so hard that I can barely type. When I'm done, I have a U.S. map with a lot of markers. Books is on the phone with an agent when I walk back in. He shakes his head quizzically and finishes his conversation before he looks carefully over the paper I've given him. "Those are the kill sites," I say with a child's overblown pride. "The different cities during his autumn travels, Labor Day to year's end last year."
"Okay, those are the orange stars, 2 kills a week, each week a different part of the country. But what are the black stars between the 2 orange ones in each location?"
"The black stars," I say, "are professional football stadiums." Books looks at the map another moment. Then his head pops up, and he looks at me like I've just discovered another planet. "He never kills on Sunday," I say.
"Oh, Jesus."
Books brings a hand to his mouth.
"Labor Day to New Year's. That's the NFL season."
"He's not traveling on business," I say. "He's going to pro football games."
66. "Last year's autumn kill spree," I begin. "September 8th, 2011, the first known kill in Atlantic Beach, Florida. September 9th, the second kill in Lakeside, Florida. And what's right between them? Everbank Field, the home of the Jacksonville Jaguars, where the Jags hosted the Tennessee Titans that Sunday, September 11th.
I look over at Books, the one who told me to refer to Jacksonville's football team as the Jags, to give me street cred with the rest of the predominantly male team. We're video conferencing with the entire task force.
"Who won the game?"
someone asks. There's always a comedian in every bunch. "The Jags, 16-14, I answer. Another nod from Books. "The following week, 2 more kill sites, September 16 in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and September 17 in Monroe, North Carolina. And the next day, he took in the Carolina-Green Bay game at Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte."
"A different stadium every week," says Books. "And no patterns to the teams either. It's not like he followed the Colts or the Bears or anyone around the country. There's no pattern we've discerned from the locations he selected. Good teams, bad teams, evenly matched games versus lopsided ones. There's no pattern to them."
"Except that he stayed away from the Midwest," I add, "because the Midwest is his stomping ground for the off-season."
"He never went to the same stadium twice?"
someone asks. "Not last year, no. This year, the season's just begun. In the first week of the NFL season, he killed that couple in Nebraska and then a man outside Denver, which means he would have gone to the Broncos-Steelers game in Denver that Sunday. And just this week, the second week of the season, he killed in New Britain, Connecticut, and in Providence, Rhode Island. We figured he would then speed home to the Midwest, and his only means of exit was Interstate 95, heading south-southwest through Connecticut, so we roadblocked it." I use my pointer along I-95, heading in the opposite direction. "But he didn't go home on Saturday night. He took I-95 north into Massachusetts. He went to the New England Patriots game today in Foxborough." I don't make eye contact with Books. When he and I were working this all out, and we realized that we had totally pegged our subject last night, but that we blocked I-95 in the wrong direction, I couldn't speak for a good 10 minutes. We had him. We were so close. We had him down to the frickin' highway on which he was traveling. And still, he evaded us. And now 2 more people will die agonizing deaths this coming week. Books, probably sensing my despair, jumps in.
"But the point is, he didn't visit Denver's or New England's stadium last year. Which means he seems to be on a path to keep going to a new stadium, one he's never visited, every week until he's visited them all."
"So let's assume that," I say. "Let's assume his next trip will be to a stadium he didn't visit last year. Let's further assume it won't be a Midwestern stadium because it's his backyard. So that removes the Chicago Bears, the Indianapolis Colts, the St. Louis Rams, and the Kansas City Chiefs. Bottom line, there are 4 stadiums we don't think he'll visit, plus the 2 that he already has."
"Okay, what does that leave?"
someone asks. A woman. "There are 32 NFL teams and 31 stadiums because the Jets and Giants share one," I say. "So 31 is the number.
He visited 17 stadiums last year and 2 more this year, that's 19. Then disregard the 4 Midwestern teams, and that's 23 that are off his list. That leaves 8 more stadiums, folks. 8 more stadiums.
And of those 8 remaining teams, only 5 have home games this week,
Books chimes in.
The Oakland Raiders, Dallas Cowboys, Cleveland Browns, Washington Redskins, and Seattle Seahawks.
The Seahawks are a Monday night game, so we think we can rule out Seattle. He's going to one of the other 4 areas this coming week, I say.
So what do we do? Asks one of the agents on the video feed. Send out a general alert to be on the lookout for an average-looking white male with no distinguishing characteristics who might have made an appointment with you or who might show up at your door unannounced?
He's right. That's the problem. We don't have a good image of the man, and we don't know his MO very well either. He scheduled an appointment with Curtis Valentine in Champaign, Illinois, but we don't know how he got to the others. What can we tell people? What kind of an alert can we send?
We'll put all local law enforcement on alert for any residential fire with a quick turnaround to us, just like we did in the Northeast this week,
Books says.
And once we know his first kill of next week, we'll know where he is and which football game he's attending.
We have to wait for him to kill again, in other words. It's as depressing as it sounds, but it's our only lead thus far.
And once we know that, says one of the agents, we'll be able to narrow him down to one of 80,000 people watching a ball game.
True,
Books concedes.
We have to think about how to handle that crowd. But we're fairly confident that whichever location he chooses, he will be inside a football stadium for 3 hours this coming Sunday. Now we'll have to decide what to do with that window of time.
It will be tricky, but we'll have to come up with something. For that short period of time, we'll have our subject in a steel box. We have to make sure he doesn't get out. 67.
Graham Session, recording number 15, September 17th, 2012. I started by watching her tonight. I watched her tonight in the most revealing of ways. That is, when she didn't know I was watching her. I slipped into the bar, you see. Surely you appreciate by now my abilities to move about undetected. When I met her at this bar last week, Mary had mentioned that she worked here, and it was my good fortune that she happens to be a bartender. So she was relatively stationary while I lurked in the corner, watching her from a distance. I watched her when business was light, the dinner hour, as I ate the basic pub food and then opened a laptop computer as an excuse to linger. I watched her when business picked up for the Monday night football game. I watched her when people were rude to her and when people flirted with her. I watched her when she had moments to herself and when she interacted with the manager and other staff. And then I slipped into the bathroom so I could remove my baseball cap and glasses and pull down the collar on my jacket. When I reappeared in the bar, crowded enough to provide me cover, I made my way to the bar as if I had just arrived. I will admit to a stirring of butterflies in my stomach. Yes, my friends, I was nervous. I took a stool at the bar and waited my turn like any other patron. I decided I would act surprised to see her, as if I was just coming to this bar like I did last week and didn't expect to see her here. Would I pretend not to remember her name? Would I struggle a moment, snap my fingers and say, Mary, right? When she approached me, with a soft smile playing on her face, all of my deliberative functions ceased to operate. Her dark hair was pulled back into a loose ponytail, but a few curls had sprung loose. Her eyes squinted, showing crow's feet at the corners. The lighting was poor, casting her eyes a shade darker than I recalled last time I saw her up close. Well, Graham, she said, I was beginning to think you were going to ignore me all night. She did it again. She put me on my heels before I even said hello. Last time she caught me recording my thoughts while pretending it was a phone. The first person who's ever figured out my ruse. This time she knew I was lurking in the back of the bar, not necessarily in disguise, but certainly obscuring my features. And she remembered my name. So then it was incumbent on me to come up with something witty, yes? Something clever, perhaps self-deprecating. That would typically be my trademark. A quick comeback of biting sarcasm, delivered with a deadpan expression. Something to keep up my end of the conversation. But before I realized it, my mouth was moving and words were coming out. I said, I was nervous about seeing you. Friends, I must tell you, time stopped for me just then. I wanted to reach into the air and snatch those words back. My entire soul was laid bare at that moment. What have I done, I thought, in those few beats of time, those few torturous breaths of oxygen? How can I take it back? Will she think I'm pathetic? And this is what happened next. She broke eye contact with me, the corners of her mouth lifting slightly higher. She worked a rag across the bar top, and she said to me, "Well, Graham, that's about the sweetest thing you could say to a girl. Do you remember what that feels like? That moment when there is a connection between you and someone else, that flutter in your chest when you realize you've crossed that small bridge, that there is at least some mutuality of feeling? Maybe Mary and I can't believe I'm saying this, but maybe Mary and I..." "No. No, no, no. Slow down, Graham. Tread cautiously. Move slowly. We wouldn't want anyone to get hurt." End.
68. My eyes look up from the computer screen. My head lolls back so that I am staring at a blank ceiling. My vision is fuzzy from sleep deprivation and staring into a computer for hours. Books knocks on my office door.
"There's still some Chinese food in the conference room," he says.
"Sounds good," I say without conviction.
"Hey."
He comes over to me and puts a hand on my shoulder.
"If you're not going to sleep, you at least have to eat. You're skin and bones as it is."
"Always have been. 5'9" and 120 pounds since I was a teenager. Long and lanky. Athletic would be the kind way of saying it. Not demure and shapely like my sister, or, for that matter, my mother.
"Okay, we have them," says Sophie Talamus, bouncing into the room. "The teams themselves, the legal ticket brokers, we have them all now. Everyone who's bought a ticket to an NFL game this week in Oakland, Dallas, Washington, or Cleveland."
I spin my chair around and nod to her.
"Okay, you know what to do," I say.
The research analysts are going to perform their magic, looking through all of these names and running them through our databases.
"Don't look so excited," Sophie says.
I make a face. I'm not excited.
"Emmy doesn't think our subject's on any of those lists," says Books.
"He wouldn't buy a ticket that way where he gets in someone's database," I say. "He'd pay in cash. My guess is he's going to scalp a ticket at the game." I cringe at the word scalp, given the method of torture our subject prefers. I got the word from Books, the sports enthusiast. When he first mentioned scalping a ticket, I pictured someone with a serrated knife. Sophie rubs her eyes. She's put in serious hours as well. We all have.
"You think tonight'll be his first kill of the week?"
I shrug. It's Wednesday night. The earlier in the week that our subject shows himself to us, pins himself down to some location in the country, the sooner we'll know which football stadium he'll visit, and the more effectively we can prepare. So as completely bizarre as it may sound for me to say that I'm hoping he kills someone tonight, it's the unfortunate truth.
Go home,
Books says to me, home being a hotel room.
You can work on the laptop from bed. We've got all sorts of people looking for this guy now, Emmy. You're not a one-person show anymore.
I drill a finger onto the desk. I'm staying right here, I say. And if we pinpoint him to a location tonight, I'm going there with you. 69.
Graham Session, recording number 16, September 19th, 2012. I want you to listen to this. This is from tonight, from Mary and me. I met her after she got off work. Me. Can I ask you something, Mary? Why did you agree to see me tonight? Mary. You mean, why did I agree to go out with you after I caught you spying on me in the back of the bar on Monday? Me. I might have chosen a more charitable account of events, but yes. Why? I might have thought you'd find me odd. Mary, laughing. I do find you odd, Graham. Me. Ah, glad we have that settled. Mary, I told you before, I like a little quirkiness in men. It was, I don't know, it was kind of endearing. Flattering, too. I'm not used to somebody getting nervous over me. Me. I find that hard to believe. Mary. You think there's a big market demand out there for a 37-year-old bartender who's a recovering alcoholic? Mary. Oops, I spooked you. That's a heck of a way to introduce that piece of information. But, yes, I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for over 10 years, if that's any consolation. Me. No, I think that's rather extraordinary. Mary. Oh, I don't know about that. I'm just facing down my demons like everyone else. Me. But you're building a new life. You're taking college courses during the day and working at night. That's very impressive, I think. Mary. That's nice of you to say. Me. Mary, why would you work at a bar if you're a recovering alcoholic? Mary. I know. It doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Mostly because I needed a job that was nights only so I could go to school during the day, and a friend of mine owns the bar. Maybe I like the challenge, too. Me. The challenge? Mary. Yeah. Knowing I can stare it in the face and beat it every day. It's like every day I look at those bottles of booze and say, I don't need you anymore. I beat you. It's empowering. Me, facing down your demons. Mary, yeah, exactly. Don't you have demons, Graham? I thought that whole exchange was remarkable. The way she so easily opened herself up to me. The way she looked me in the eye and said, "This is who I am." People don't do that. They don't show their true selves. They hide behind layers and layers of self-deception and outward deception. They wear masks. They put up fronts. They lie. They hide. What was I supposed to say back to her? I really wanted to reciprocate. I really did. I mean, she lays out the sordid details of her life right there as easily as she takes a breath. And what do I do in return? Do I say, I have some demons of my own, Mary? No. I change the subject. That's what I do. And it's not like she didn't notice. She drops these revelations, and suddenly I want to talk about this darn weather we're having. It was obvious. I think she knows. I mean, she doesn't know. She couldn't, possibly. But she senses something about me. I know she does. Oh, and this smile she has. I wish you could see it, the way her nose wrinkles up and her eyes squint. It is one of the most sincere and true smiles I've ever seen. She is so quick to let happiness in, and so firm in keeping out the venom, the poisonous thoughts. And her smell. There is this trace of strawberry. I think it's her shampoo. When I smell it, I think of the word fresh. And really, there isn't a better word to describe Mary. Oh, and then the end of the night, after I walked her to the door, I can't remember ever being so nervous. My hands stuffed in my pockets, my eyes down, shifting weight from one foot to the other. I'm telling you, I must have looked like an awkward schoolboy on his first date. And I kissed her. I'm not sure how I moved from point A to point B, but somewhere in there I mustered up my courage, and I leaned in, and she met me halfway. It was so soft and slow and sweet. Our lips pressed gently together, her hand caressing my cheek. I felt a charge of electricity throughout my body. I felt weightless. I feel weightless now. End.
70.
Shit.
I push myself away from my desk, rolling in my chair halfway across my office. I get to my feet and get a nice dose of vertigo, the walls turning sideways, the floor angling up toward me. I grip my chair to reclaim my equilibrium. Shit, I repeat, because it seems to capture the moment. I'm falling apart. I know that. I'm pulling virtual all-nighters and not eating. I'm not going to be able to sustain this much longer. And what do I have to show for it? First Wednesday night, and now Thursday night, tethered to my computer and phone, waiting all night for the call from one of the locales where we expect our subject to go. Oakland, Dallas, Washington, Cleveland, awaiting any notice of a residential fire that we can link to him. And so far, nothing. Sure, a few calls came in, a house fire in Sausalito, a diner in Cleveland that went up in flames, probably a Greek lightning fire, an arson by a restaurant owner going out of business looking to collect insurance money. But nothing that comes close to our guy. It's 5 in the morning now. Friday morning. I haven't had more than a cat nap since Tuesday night. I need to get a few hours of sleep so I can stay up again tonight. Friday night, when he's sure to attack. Simple math. If he's going to kill 2 people this week before Sunday, he'll have to do the first one Friday night. Great. I know for certain that tonight will be the night and I'll be falling asleep at my desk. Deflated and groggy, my neck and back reaching the status of rigor mortis, my fingers tired from the rapid-fire typing all night, my vision as clear as fog, I leave the FBI building and take the rental car back to my hotel. I get out of my car and slam the door shut. The crisp air of a fall morning provides a moment of relief. Outdoors, yes. I remember there is such a thing as outdoors. Fresh air. A tinge of pain hits me behind my eyes, dark circles clouding the fringes of my vision, as if I'm looking through a tunnel. I have to go to bed, I realize. Maybe just a few hours.
That's her!
I hear a woman yell. My reaction time is slowed, but I'm jumpy all the same, and my immediate response, danger, takes longer than normal to dissipate before I realize that the man and woman rushing toward me are not coming to do me harm. Not physical harm, anyway. One of them is carrying a recorder in her hand, the other a handheld camera.
Agent Dockery, says the reporter, a pretty young African-American woman. Diane Bell from the Tribune.
This is a new one for me, the first time a reporter has ever confronted me like this. The words shoot into my brain, no comment, and I'm not an agent. But instead, I just say, yes,
Agent Dockery, I understand that you're chasing a serial killer around the country, a man who has killed possibly dozens of people and burned up the evidence to hide his crimes.
I shake my head, show the cameraman the palm of my hand, and start walking toward my hotel. I can't comment on an ongoing investigation.
I say it robotically, something I've heard others say, politicians under fire and stone-faced prosecutors. No comment. We can't comment on an ongoing investigation.
So there is an investigation, she says.
Great. Thank you.
I shake my head violently, which doesn't help my shaky equilibrium. I keep walking, picking up the pace, turning my shoulder to shield myself from her as I near the entrance to the hotel. If I'm not careful, I'm going to fall over on camera.
Curtis Valentine, she says. Joelle Swanson?
I reach the door of the hotel and push it open.
Your sister, Marta?
I snap my head around to her, but don't say anything. She raises her hand in a calming gesture and approaches me.
I know it all anyway, Agent, she says. Your sister was one of the victims, and you've been on a crusade. You found this killer when nobody else believed you.
My mind is racing. I'm out of my league. I don't even know the protocol. Special agents are trained to deal with the press. Research analysts? Nobody ever wants to talk to us.
Who told you that?
I manage. She drops her head a notch, a tisk-tisk look. Right. Reporters don't reveal their sources. It's all a one-way street with them. Take my card, she says, and for some reason I do.
This is an amazing story, Emmy. Don't you want to tell your side?
No, I say, and I push my way into the hotel. 71. Books runs his hand over his face. His eyes are red and unfocused, his face drawn. He's had more sleep than me, but that's not saying much. College students cramming for final exams have gotten more sleep than me.
We never comment on the existence or non-existence of an investigation,
Books says to me gently, like a parent to a child. I dig a knuckle into my eye.
I didn't say anything.
You confirmed that there was an investigation.
She knew names, including Marta's. She already knew there was a damn investigation.
Books' eyes meet mine, but he doesn't push it. He's made his point. No matter how much that reporter already knew, she didn't have FBI confirmation of an investigation until I gave it to her. I throw up my hands in surrender.
I screwed up.
Books doesn't quarrel with that assessment.
How did they get the story?
I ask, but it's a rhetorical question. The reporter will never tell, and it doesn't matter anyway.
My guess? One of the local cops working the Joelle Swanson or Curtis Valentine cases.
Books shakes his head.
These guys are always looking for favors. I give you this tip, remember to make me look good next time there's a story involving one of my cases, that kind of thing. Or maybe it was one of the victims' families. Frankly, I'm surprised it took this long to leak out.
Well, the timing sucks.
I throw a pen across the room.
Here he thinks he's gotten away with everything. He's going about his business wherever he is this week, killing these people with the clever cover-up, thinking he has everyone fooled, and he's going to walk into a football stadium this Sunday and we're going to nail him. And now? Now he's going to know we're coming.
Books' cell phone rings. He looks at me with an apologetic smirk.
The dick,
he says. He punches the button for speakerphone and answers.
This is Books,
he says.
I have Emmy with me.
Ah, yes. Well done, Emmy. On the eve of the greatest lead we have in this case, you tell the Chicago Tribune all about our investigation.
Books rolls his eyes, mostly for my benefit. The dick is probably enjoying having the upper hand again, being able to call me out on a screw-up, however much he exaggerates it.
I just got off the phone with the editors,
Dickinson tells us.
They weren't very forthcoming with what they knew. They have some victims' names. They know that Emmy has a personal involvement in this investigation.
Books and I exchange looks. A nice jab from Dickinson. I'm sure the dick would like nothing more than to fire me for this. If I didn't have that episode in his office hanging over his head, he'd surely do just that.
And it sounds like they might have an autopsy report. They know there are multiple locations throughout the country where our subject is killed, but they don't seem to have it all in a tidy package. And they didn't say anything about our most recent information, like the video footage of the subject from the bar, or any connection to professional football games.
I shake my head. It doesn't matter. They know that Curtis Valentine and Joelle Swanson and my sister are being classified as murders, not accidental fires. That's the whole ball of wax for him. He doesn't want us looking for a murderer, period, much less him. Once he sees this article, he'll know we're on to his methods. So much for sneaking up on him. The dick says,
"Then you'll thank me for getting the editors at the Tribune to hold off on the story until Monday."
"Oh, that's great," says Books. "That's great."
He puts out his hand and calms the air between us.
"So there's hope for us yet."
"What did you have to give them?" I ask.
"First access if and when the case breaks."
Books gives a who cares shrug.
"So you have this weekend, this one chance to isolate the subject in whatever football stadium he visits," says Dickinson. "Do us all a favor and try not to fuck up anything else between now and then."
72.
Graham Session, recording number 17, September 22nd, 2012. Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does my love for you grow? With sweet little smiles and feminine wiles, and your ponytail tied in a bow. I think we can all agree that needs a little work. Mother Goose, I am not. But in a good mood, I am. Oh, listen to me, I'm starting to sound like Yoda from Star Wars, as opposed to Yoda the Supreme Court Justice, or Yoda the Union Carpenter. There's only one Yoda. I don't need to qualify it. Silly, I am. Oh, God, I do feel silly. I'm giddy. Changing my clothes twice before tonight's date, fixing my hair, brushing my teeth twice. I even did some push-ups so that if she touches my arm or puts her hands on me, she'll feel some hard muscle. Is that normal? To primp like that? What do I care? If this is abnormal, then I'll take abnormal. Okay, take a deep breath. I don't want to spook her. I don't want to push her away by seeming too eager. You can be too eager, can't you? I mean, maybe she just enjoys my company, but isn't ready for some big commitment. God, look at all my instruments. The forceps are a mess. The chisel will need to be replaced soon. I think I'm going to switch from the 10mm to the 8 when I get a new one. Harder to sharpen and probably harder to clean, but greater precision, too. It's all about precision. And the bone curettes have seen better days, too. What's happening to me? Once upon a time, I'd clean the instruments meticulously the moment I returned home. This is what you're doing to me, Mary. You're distracting me. But I don't mind being distracted. Am I ready for a commitment? Oh, see, I'm doing it again. I'm making this too big, too fast. She's a nice girl, Graham, a very sweet woman. Maybe there's something there long term, but you don't have to make that decision right now or tonight. Take it slow. Isn't that what people say? Take it slow? Okay. Yes, that's just it. If I seem too eager, she'll pull back. Just be yourself. Be relaxed and let it happen. Oh, here's the bad news about Mary. She works Mondays through Wednesdays, which leaves her best nights to socialize Thursday through Sunday. What rotten luck! Those are the nights that I take my little road trips. The nights I'm away are the nights she's free. Is that a sign that we're not meant to be? Okay, See, this is what I can't do. I can't put too much pressure on this. Let's just have a nice Saturday night date and take it slow. God, I'm speaking in cliches. But they're cliches because they're true, I guess. Just take it slow, relax, let the relationship breathe. Like a young Cabernet Sauvignon. But don't overthink it the other way either. Don't spend so much time trying to look disinterested that you give off the wrong vibe. Don't try too hard. Be yourself. Be myself. How can I be myself? I'm making myself crazy. Just go and have fun and don't have any expectations. Good. Yes. That's the ticket. Just go have fun and don't think beyond tonight. And don't forget to change the blade on the amputating knife. Just in case. End.
73. My eyes so heavy I can hardly raise them. I watch the clock in my office hit 4 o'clock. 4 in the morning. Saturday night has come and gone without incident. I pick up the stapler on my desk and throw it at the clock, missing badly, putting a dent in the wall, chips of paint scattering on the carpet. 4 consecutive nights of all-nighters, Wednesday night through Saturday night, with nothing to show for it but bags under my eyes and failing vision. Books, hearing the commotion, enters my office with trepidation, wary of being the target of a flying office supply.
What, he took the week off? I shout. He just decided, oh no, not this week.
He doesn't do that. He's never done that. He's like a robot. The 1 week we're ready for him, the one last chance we have before the newspapers run their story and tip him off and he takes a fucking vacation?
Books leans against the door.
I know, I don't get it. But we deal with it. We have no choice.
Oh, would you stop being so damn calm?
I hiss.
We could have ambushed him this week, Books. We had him. Now he's going to know we're coming.
Maybe not, Em. We don't even know what the Tribune article's going to say. Let's just do our best to control what we can control.
I shake my head, my vision blurring in the process. When my eyes come back into focus, I am looking at the article from Marta's hometown paper, the Peoria Times, the one written last month about how I was demanding that the Peoria Police Department treat Marta's death as a murder, not an accidental fire.
We understand Ms. Dockery is distraught,
the police chief was quoted as saying,
but we can't allocate our resources based on the whims of a grieving sister. The police detectives, fire chief, and forensic pathologist all agree that Marta Dockery died of smoke inhalation from an accidental fire.
Books follows my line of vision and sees the article, stuck to the cushion board on the wall by my computer with a blue tack.
Look how far you've come. What's the date of that article? August 7th of this year? That article made you look like a quack, like an irrational sister who believed in Santa Claus. And now look at you, Emmy. 6 weeks later, you've not only convinced the Bureau that you were right, but also put into motion an intensive manhunt, and we're getting close. Look how close we are, Emmy. Before he threw us this curveball, we were ready to throw a net over a football stadium and catch this asshole today. We'll have another chance. I promise you we will. We're inside his head now. We have his pattern down, no matter that he took this week off. Hey, look at me.
Suddenly he's right next to me, hovering over me without my noticing. Maybe that's because his invasion of my personal space never used to be an invasion. It was his space, too. That was a simpler time. It was easier with him than it was without. It felt more natural. It felt right. Like we were just jagged puzzle pieces that made no sense alone, but together, we fit perfectly. That's what life's supposed to be about for normal people, right? You find that other piece that matches yours, that completes yours, and you make the jags and the crevices fit, even if they don't go in perfectly smooth. Even if they require a few adjustments. You don't demand perfection. You make it work and appreciate the parts that fit instead of obsessing over the small angles that don't. I look up into his eyes,
I've seen the longing in his eyes before. I've returned that longing. But I know that I'm too broken right now for any meaningful response. Books knows it too. As I've said before, he knows me better than I know myself.
We're going to catch him, he says, and we're going to do it soon.